welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline D'Est, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Welcome to Ride Through the Roof. Today I'm speaking with Gareth L. Powell. How's it going, Gareth?
It's going well, thank you.
Great. Okay, so just a little introduction about Gareth. So Gareth is an award-winning science fiction writer from Bristol. His alternative history thriller, Akak Macaque, won the 2013 British Sci-Fi Association Award for Best Novel. He's written short story collections and a macaque trilogy, and his new novel, Embers of War, is the first in an epic space opera trilogy, and it's out in February. So thanks for speaking with me today, Gareth.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So how I like to start off is a few warm-up questions. So think of it as some jogging on the spot, you know, a few side bends, some toe touches.
Oh, I'm exhausted already.
So you've written short story collections and now you're writing trilogies. What is your favourite writing medium?
Well, I started off in short stories, mainly because I didn't have either the time or the confidence to tackle a novel. So I wrote an awful lot of short stories, but having written my first novel back in, ages ago, came out in 2010 anyway. Now, suddenly, every idea I get is roughly 90,000 words long. So I seem to have lost the knack of the short story along the way somewhere. So I would have to say novels at the moment.
Mm. Okay, great. So, and do you write every day?
I try to, apart from weekends. Yeah, it's not, I don't always manage to write every day. I certainly think about writing every day.
Right. So do you have any writing rituals?
I kind of have a writing routine, whereas I'll get up in the morning, get my kids ready for school, see them out the door, and then I'll go and read a book in the bath for half an hour, come down, get myself a mug of tea, and then write through to when they come home from school. So I've kind of got that block of time and everything. That's when I try and get all the writing done. As to rituals, I have a few. I'm not very superstitious, but I have a few kind of relics around the place. So I've got pinned up on the notice board behind my monitor, I've got a Maori trickster god that a friend of mine brought me back from New Zealand when we were, I think we were 6 or 7 years old. I've had it ever since. And I've got an Irish rune, which is supposed to be the rune for inspiration. So I've got that up there as well on a little, carved into a little stone. And I've got various other sort of little knickknacks around the office that kind of, there's a pebble here that was painted by my niece, who lives in France. She started her own business painting pebbles and selling them to the neighbours, and so she's painted me a pebble there. So I've got these little things around that aren't kind of necessary to write, but just kind of make me feel kind of in a writing kind of mood.
Yeah, fantastic. So Maori trickster dolls inspiring you.
Yeah, he's. I think he's called Kon-Tiki.
Oh, yeah, yes.
Yeah, he's the god of mischief or something. I think it's a little plastic figure given away free by Air New Zealand way back in about 1975, 76. But he's been with me a long time.
I can absolutely picture it now being from that end of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get a little more into your writing. So how do you describe your writing, and are there any themes that you like to explore?
I kind of describe my writing in two ways. The first way would be awesome. but no, seriously. Yeah, it's kind of I'm very much character focused, so the characters have to be very alive for me as much as possible. I really try to. I have plots, and you know they're quite complicated plots, but I like to try and make it feel that the characters are driving the action and that their decisions are, you know, driving the book. Which in the Macaque trilogy was a problem because the character of the monkey, Akak Macaque, was such a irascible force of nature that he could cut through any plot that I came up with and just by going, no, I don't think I'll do that. And yeah, I've got, there's chapters where I was going to have this huge exposition scene and he's just sat there going, blah, 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 blah. And it just cuts the scene to pieces. So I have to move on and do something else. So I try to make the characters and their journey there. I have to, their journeys are very important to me as well. They have to go from one place to another. And it's very much usually a learning experience for them, but also, especially in the monkey books, he starts off as this indestructible, or he thinks he's this indestructible sort of character, sweeping all before him. And by the end of it, by the end of the three books, he's gone through a lot. He's grown up a lot. He's become vulnerable. He's allowed his guard to go down a little bit. So he's gathering this sort of ersatz family of people around him. And it's, I suppose it's a metaphor for growing up. It's, you know, especially sort of a male midlife crisis almost. You go from being this indestructible teenager to allowing yourself to be vulnerable and to let people in. And you get a lot wiser through the experience.
I was about to ask what inspired the character, but sounds like it could be a little bit personal.
No, he just came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Years and years ago, I was just sitting around. I tend to play with words in my head, make up terrible raps to annoy the children and stuff. But I was just sort of tootling around, and I knew the word Akak because it's slang for anti-aircraft fire. And I read a lot of Biggles books when I was younger, so I knew that word. And then I was just thinking about it, and then the word macaque drifted in and collided with it. And I wasn't quite sure at that time what a macaque was offhand. I had an idea it was like a small, furry, bush-tailed thing. But it turns out it was a monkey. But the two words stuck together in my head, and I wrote them down. And then a few weeks later, I was writing a short story, which was later published in Interzone. But in this short story, it was the tale of a relationship falling apart. And one of the characters was a web animator. So I needed a cartoon character for this web animator. So I was thinking, oh, what can I have? Can I have a mouse or a goose? And I came across this phrase, Akak Macaque, and I thought, oh, I'll have that. And then it just appeared in front of me because with the anti-aircraft fire, he was going to be an aircraft pilot because it's quite an old bit of slang. He'd be a World War II aircraft pilot. And then the cigar appeared and the eye patch appeared and the two guns appeared. And then I found out a macaque was a monkey. And then there he was, fully formed in my brain. So I don't know where he came from, whether he's some sort of bastard offspring of Biggles and John Belushi from the film 1941. He came from somewhere. It's sort of slouched out of my unconscious. I think he's probably like the id to my ego or vice versa. He's he's definitely the Mr. Hyde to my Dr. Jekyll.
Fantastic. So in your writing journey, which I am loath to use that expression, what do you think is the one thing that has improved your writing?
Reading. Reading. The more I read, the better I write. It's absolutely as simple as that. I was trying for years to write a novel and I never got anywhere. Because all I was reading was sort of, I was reading a lot of Arthur C. Clarke and old Larry Niven books and so on. And I couldn't really, I couldn't really write in that style. That wasn't me. And then I came across William Gibson's short story collection, Burning Chrome. Mm-hmm. And that just kicked me in the head. That was like, you know, people who say they bought the first Velvet Underground album and everyone who bought it went out and formed their own band. It was that kind of thing on me. It was like, wow, this is how it can be. Because suddenly it was, you know, everything was, it was tight language. There was a tremendous energy to it, and it completely revolutionized the way I saw sci-fi. You didn't have to be some super capable scientist. You could write about people in the street. You could write about normal people. And that just grabbed me, and I suddenly, everything fell into place, and I knew I could write about losers, and I could write about flawed human beings, rather than these sort of old school Clarkian sort of competent men who can do absolutely everything and know absolutely everything. And then over the years, the more I've read, the more influences that have come in, the more examples I've seen of people pushing the boat out and so on. Everything you read just widens your experience a bit, widens the palette, really. You can kind of draw, you can see that there are wider places to draw things from.
Yeah, that's really interesting because of, I know that when I first started writing, you know, that you do that first draft and you think, oh, you know, because I'm not like, you know, Arthur C. Clarke, let's say, oh, this must be terrible, rather than finding where you fit naturally.
Yes, absolutely. And it was a kind of lesson to me not to measure myself against people as well, because you never know if you're measuring yourself against the right people.
So, are you trying anything new at the moment?
In terms of just sort of nuts and bolts writing, my sister gave me a good idea a couple of months ago. My sister's also a novelist. She lives in France. Her name's Rebecca Powell. She wrote a novel recently called The Brazilian Husband, which is available on Amazon. But she gave me a good idea, which was, on the days when you're stuck and the words aren't coming and writing 1,000 words seems like a lot to do, she said what she does is she just sits down and says, right, I'm going to write 100 words today, because what's that? 2 sentences, 3 sentences, a paragraph? It's easy. I can do 100 words. So she sits down and she does 100 words. And then once she's done that, if nothing else comes, well, she's done 100 words. That's progress. But, you know, 8 times out of 10, she does the 100 words and then another 100 words come along, and then that kickstarts and she starts rolling. So I've kind of been doing that every day. I've been just making sure I write 100 words every day, even on the days when I really don't feel like it. And, you know, it gets me going. It gets things rolling. So, and even if it doesn't, at least I'm 100 words closer to the end. So that's my new thing at the moment.
Yeah, good, good, good. I follow you on Twitter, so I see that what you're up to. You've also been moving from sci-fi into crime.
Yes. What's crime that? Fiction, not actual crime.
Oh, I'm disappointed. So how's that changed your writing?
It's interesting, actually, because when I wrote the Macaque books, although they're sci-fi and they've got some fantastic elements in them, a lot of the action is Earth-based in the very near future, and it's quite thrillerish, which is why I describe it as an alternative history thriller more than anything else. So I kind of thought, well, if I took the kind of monkey out of this, you know, why not have a bash at writing a sort of a straight sort of thriller? So I started doing it, and somewhere along the way it kind of morphed into this small town murder mystery. So, you know, that's what I'm writing at the moment. And it's a completely different genre in a way. It is a completely different genre, but it's a completely different way of thinking about writing as well. So at the moment I'm about a third of the way into writing the crime novel, but I'm also a third of the way into writing the third Embers of War book for Titan. And because they're so different, I can kind of switch between the two without muddying the waters, because it's like proactive procrastination. If I'm stuck on one, I'll just go over and I'll think, all right, I'll work on the other one today, while my brain has sort of clicks away the problem on the second one. So I can switch between the two because they're so different. In fact, they're so different that my agent and I are discussing whether I should try and sell the crime novel under a thinly disguised pseudonym so as not to confuse audiences. But it's interesting, and if it goes nowhere, at least it's an interesting experiment. Just to try writing something completely different.
Has it taught you anything new, do you think, at this stage? Can you identify anything?
No, I'm pretty much writing it the same way I've written the other 8 novels I've written to date. In that I kind of think I know where I'm going when I start, and then about 20,000 words in, everything goes completely off the rails and we're into uncharted territory. So I knew who the killer was, but in about chapter 6 or 7, he turns up dead. So it seemed to work at the time, but it's completely thrown the entire plot out. So we're kind of, I'm improvising a lot at the moment, but that's what I said earlier about characters kind of taking over and leading the way. It's that it made perfect sense for this guy to have been offed, even though I thought he was going to be the main villain. So yeah, it's the same kind of experience for me, in that I've kind of got a sketch map of the territory, but I'm making it all up as I go along.
That's interesting, because I've spoken to some other mystery writers and they've got like hardcore spreadsheets and things like that, so it's just funny how everyone does things differently.
Yes, yeah, I was listening to an interview with David Baladucci, is that how you pronounce it?
Oh, yeah.
The thriller writer, on TV the other day, and he said he never knows how – he's never started a book knowing the ending. And since he writes 3 massive, thick sort of mystery thrillers a year, that blew my mind slightly. But yeah, so it made me feel good about not having, as you say, plotted it all out on spreadsheets and stuff. So I think in the first draft, I can just let it all hang out and go for it and come up with a story. And then, and I mean, in crime, obviously there's an expectation on behalf of the audience and so on. So I'm going to have to, there'll be further drafts to tidy it up and make sure I leave no kind of red herrings or, you know, any huge plot holes. But at the moment, I'm just going for it and having fun.
Cool. Sounds good. So let's talk about Embers of War. So what inspired that, and were you trying anything different?
In a way, I was kind of going back to my roots a bit with it, because before I wrote the Monkey Trilogy, I wrote 2 other novels which were both space operas. There was Silver Sands, which is a very short novel, which was kind of like my that was the novel I'd been trying to write since I was a teenager, and so it kind of got all the different bits and bobs came out of it, and it's kind of like my growing up novel. So I'm slightly embarrassed by it now. Although I did look back at it a while ago, and it read better than I expected. It's I think it's that whole thing, you look back at yourself, your younger self, and you're really embarrassed, but people look back at your younger self and think, oh, you're quite cool. So and then the other one, which was my first novel for Solaris before the Monkey books, was called The Recollection, and it's a space opera about a London taxi driver who accidentally gets transported 400 years into the future, trying to find his brother in order to apologise for sleeping with his brother's wife, and ends up in the middle of a space opera. So that was a hell of a lot of fun. I'm really fond of that book. It's still available from Solaris, and I just had an absolute riot writing it. It was the sci-fi book I wanted to read and wanted to write. So having written 3 monkey books set on zeppelins and so on, I just wanted to get back to spaceships. Really, really to get back to spaceships. I wanted to get back to sort of sarcastic, self-aware spaceships. But I didn't want to, kind of looking around at the other space operas, they all seem to be about future societies building up towards a war, building up towards these huge conflicts, whereas Embers of War is called Embers of War because it starts 3 years after the big apocalyptic conflict. So it's instead of all the build-up, it's more like what happens to all these characters afterwards. So, for instance, to take a not very related example, but after the Battle of Endor in Empire Strikes, but Last Jedi. I did get there eventually. In the not the Last Jedi, God, what's it called? Return of the Jedi. God, oh dear. In Return of the Jedi, there's the Battle of Endor, and then, you know, they've won, and everyone's way, and all the Ewoks are dancing around, and people have forgotten that they're cannibals. And but you think that there's all these, like, scattered across the galaxy, there are former stormtroopers, there are rebel soldiers, and who've been in these horrendous battles, they've done these horrendous things, you know, they've blown up Alderaan, must have been fighting on hundreds of worlds. They've lost friends, they've lost, you know, comrades, they've been fighting on the wrong side, they've kind of, you know, there's all this fallout that is sort of tidily swept under the carpet. And that's kind of where my book is. It's these people who've been on different sides in this huge war, but are now working together for an organization that rescues spaceships in distress. So sort of like Thunderbirds. The inspiration for that actually came from, I was reading a piece about the Titanic, and it was saying that the Titanic is famous because it was the first big shipwreck like that where they had a radio, so they could call for help. Whereas before that, there were several other big liners lost in the Atlantic, some of who were, you know, bigger losses than the Titanic, but they just didn't have a radio. So they set off from Liverpool one day and they never turned up in America. Nobody knew whatever happened to them. So, and it said a phrase that, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic without a radio in those days, you might as well have been on the dark side of the moon. And I kind of thought, yeah, that like early space travel, you get into trouble, you're stuffed. But then a bit later, you get the Titanic, you've got a radio, you can call nearby ships. And then these days, if a liner got into trouble in the middle of the Atlantic, we'd have planes and helicopters there within a few hours. So that's kind of where the idea came from. It's like in a space opera setting, if you've got faster than light communication and faster than light travel, if your ship gets into trouble, they can call for help. And that's where the thing accreted, and I came up with this idea of this rescue organization, and then the characters can all drift into there. Even though they're on different sides in the war, now they're trying to work together for the common good.
And it's the first in a trilogy, yeah?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it was sold to Titan as a trilogy. And I've written the first two books already. And as I said, I'm about a third of the way into the third book. So they should be coming out February this year, February next year, and February 2020. Which seems like 2020 just seems like a hopelessly futuristic date to me. It's just, say 2020, it sounds like the distant future. So
absolutely, and it's only 2 years away.
I know, it's like I remember growing up, you know, in the 70s and 80s, thinking the year, reading 2000 AD, thinking the year 2000 was just hopelessly, you know, we'd all be radioactive dust long before that came round. And now suddenly we're talking, I'm scheduling things for 2020. It seems very surreal.
Okay, good. Well, I think I'll wrap up and let you get back to your juggling your couple of novels that you're working on at the same time. So where can people find you and your work?
Well, you can find my website, which is www.garethlpowell.com. There are links to everything on there. I'm on Twitter pretty much all the time, at Gareth L. Powell. The Monkey Books and the Recollection are available from Solaris Books, or you can find them on Amazon or through any good bookseller. And Embers of War is coming out on February the 20th from Titan Books. And again, it's already available to pre-order on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or all reputable book suppliers.
Fantastic. And I can see that it's got a lot of great blurbs from other really well-known writers, so looking forward to reading that myself.
Thanks. I hope you enjoy it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been really, really great.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Last week I talked about the hero's journey, and in particular Christopher Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey. While people may claim that the hero's journey can apply to male or female characters interchangeably, there is another structure known as the heroine's journey, which I've found helpful for characters of either gender, although personally the vast majority of my characters are women. The heroine's journey was developed by Maureen Murdoch as a result of her years of experience with women in therapy. The heroine's journey focuses on a woman finding her own feminine power as part of her journey to find her true self. Now, I found the description of the heroine's journey on the Miscreants website particularly useful, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Now, the heroine starts off her journey by rejecting her femininity in favour of the masculine. Then she heads off on a road of trials surrounded by masculine allies, and she tries to prove herself as good as them, while still ignoring her feminine side. She then wins a significant victory, proving she's as good as the men, but she still feels hollow inside. And then tragedy strikes, and she falls from grace, rejecting help from the others, and she descends into darkness. Then at her darkest moment, all alone, the heroine encounters the goddess, and she learns the truth about the strength of her femininity. The heroine returns to reconcile with her femininity, but she faces another crisis and must rely on her masculine attributes once again. But in the end, she realises that she needs both the feminine and the masculine to find her true self. Now, this might seem a little bit woo-woo for you, but to put it in context, a couple of popular examples of the heroine's journey are the journey of Clarice Starling in The Silence of the Lambs or Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. So I'll link to some further reading in the show notes, but I recommend that you check out the heroine's journey to help enrich your character arcs. Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?